It's time for the Faith Connection Show with your host, Dr. David Miller, equipping people to connect with their purpose. In the next half hour, you will be inspired with words of encouragement, and you'll be motivated by experts in the respective field who have been where you're trying to go on the Faith Connection Show. But first, here's an inspirational word.
This is Bawana Miller Cannon with your word of the day. Forgiveness is an essential part of every Christian's life. However, it's hard to forgive. How do you forgive someone who has hurt you? How do you overcome the anger and bitterness? The answer is simple. Release. Release yourself from the emotions that rob you of your joy and peace. Release your offender. God's word is so clear. If you want him to hear your prayers and forgive your sins, you must forgive. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. You must trust God. Don't cut off your nose to spite your face. God will handle the wrongs that are done against you. Release and rest in his promise. He'll do the rest.
So I wait, expecting my blessing right now. Applaud God in this room, everybody. Go on and give him some glory in advance. Clap your hands again. Woo! I'm so glad today I heard.
So glad today I heard you.
I heard you clearly. Now I'm grateful.
Grateful. It's right out my circumstance. All I want to do is serve you.
And love you.
Love you.
And praise you.
Praise you. You gave me another chance.
I was broken.
Things you've not been through.
Sing, Miranda.
Made me, gave me strength that I can endure.
In the secret place I'm dwelling.
In the secret place I'm dwelling.
Safely.
Safely. Ever so bravely.
Your foundation standeth sure.
Whoa.
Listen to this. Release. Give it to me.
Yes, Lord.
I need a blessing right now.
Thank you for listening to the Faith Connection Show. And here's Dr. Miller with his special guest.
We have in the studio today with us Ralph Sanchez, and Ralph is an author and has 20 years experience in integrative health care and a practitioner, and he specializes in functional medicine. And Ralph, it's good to have you in the studio today, and I just thank you for accepting the opportunity to talk to our listeners today. We want to talk to them a little bit about a disease that is really running rampant in the communities all over. Every race in this country is suffering from this disease. It's called Alzheimer's. We know that this is a disease that is just ravishing the country, and there are a lot of baby boomers that are coming down with this condition, and we wanted to talk to Ralph about it. Ralph has written a book called The Diabetic Brain in Alzheimer's Disease, and that sounds like a topic that has a interesting twist to it, because it does. I'm anxious to find out how a diabetic brain creates Alzheimer's. So, okay, Ralph, we're just glad to have you in the studio today.
Well, it's a real pleasure for me, Dr. Miller, and it's a privilege. So thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. Now, how did you get into functional medicine?
Well, I was inspired to take a dramatic turn in my life back in the late 80s and early 90s, and I went from landscaping into acupuncture school, Chinese medicine school, and I was inspired to do so because I wanted to be of service in the world and to have a more fulfilling path.
Okay. Now, you know, Ralph, the book itself, talking about how does this work with Alzheimer's? What is the correlation?
Well, early on in my practice, I was trying to figure out a lot of health issues of my own, apart from helping my patients. And I was putting two and two together, and I had a significant brain trauma early in my life as a young man. And because of the landscaping work, I had severe exposure to pesticides.
Oh.
And there were a few other things as well. It's a long story, but I'll keep it short to that.
Okay.
And I started to realize that I had a significant risk for cognitive decline as I aged because of those factors. Brain trauma alone can raise your risk for dementia as you age. And of course, pesticides are very toxic to the brain. They're called neurotoxins. And so I got very busy understanding all of that information, understanding my risk. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to know, and I decided this was going to be a central focus in my research.
Okay.
Because I wanted to write books. And so I decided that Alzheimer's was going to be the topic, and that I was going to write eventually some books on Alzheimer's disease.
Now, how did the diabetes, how does that...
How is that related to it?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you in short. So I started my practice in 1995. And around the year 1999, I discovered some information around a genetic marker. It's a well-validated, what's called risk factor for late-onset Alzheimer's disease. And I want to distinguish late-onset Alzheimer's disease from early-onset Alzheimer's disease. Early-onset Alzheimer's disease is pretty much a genetically determined disorder. If you have the genes, you will get Alzheimer's disease as you age. But with late-onset Alzheimer's disease, there is many risk factors that come together to increase your risk. The genes don't determine that you will get Alzheimer's as you age, but it increases your risk. And when I ran across that information, I got very much into the research. And then around 2005, there was a study that came out. I started my research around 1998, 1999. And in 2005, I noticed a study that referred to part of the disease process in Alzheimer's disease as resembling a type 3 diabetes.
Whoa.
And what that
now,
meant
type
was
3
that...
diabetes? I've heard
exactly.
of type 1, type 2, but what is
right.
type 3?
Well, the literature and the research definitely describes a type 3 diabetes, which is a diabetes of the brain.
Oh.
And that's the title of my book, The Diabetic Brain and Alzheimer's Disease.
Okay.
When I started to see that research and follow it closely, I decided that was going to be my book.
Okay.
And that was back in 2005, 6, and 7.
Okay, let me ask you a question now. Is this the major cause of diabetes? I know that there's no cure for it, but my question is, what are the major causes of Alzheimer's? What really causes it? Because it seems like from the literature I've read, you know, leading up to the show, is there is no real definitive cause for it that they've isolated other than the gene that you talked about.
Well, the gene just increases your risk.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many factors related to that gene and other genes, because Alzheimer's, late onset Alzheimer's disease, again, even though we know that there is one gene that significantly raises the risk, there are many other genes. So it's referred to as a polygenic disorder. In other words, many genes influence the risk for Alzheimer's, late onset Alzheimer's disease. And the one, which is APOE4, just more significantly increases your risk. But we're learning about many others as the science rolls on. And while
okay.
that's a risk factor, there are many other risk factors that are associated with
right.
a causal relationship,
right.
Which is diet and lifestyle and type 2 diabetes and heart disease. All of these significantly raise your risk for Alzheimer's disease as you age. The older you get, the more likely you are to get Alzheimer's disease because of these problems.
Okay, Ralph, then the question I have to ask here, you know, this disease really is a little sneaky. What are some of the signs that you, a person, would look for if in a loved one or, you know, period?
Yes, well, they're quite typical and they're well described in the literature. There are areas in the brain that are very important to learning and memory. So oftentimes memory, of course, will be one of the first things, but memory isn't the only thing that begins to suffer. There is something referred to as executive function in the brain, which is all about planning and decision making. So think of the CEO of a company who has to make all the decisions and run the company and make sure everything is running smoothly. Well, in a person, the executive function in the brain starts to fail. So they can't plan, they can't make decisions, they're not thinking clearly, they're not able to run their life smoothly, and that progresses and gets worse over time.
Okay. Now, also, I read in the literature that women have a much higher incident of Alzheimer's than men. What is the reason for that?
Yes, well, it's almost twice the risk. And one of the biggest reasons is estrogen. So low estrogen in a woman, not all women have low estrogen as they age, but many do. And the same as a man. We'll focus on women, but men also, if they get into low testosterone, which is very common as they age, well, that's a risk for Alzheimer's disease. So hormones can be a factor.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, go ahead.
Okay, so women that are going through menopause or some women go through menopause earlier than others, but if a woman is going through menopause, it can bring on Alzheimer's because the chemical levels in her body changes. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, absolutely. So at menopause, there is a significant shift for some women. Again, not all women, but some women's estrogen levels really decline seriously at menopause.
Okay.
And estrogen governs glucose metabolism. In other words, the estrogen in a woman's body dictates how well they're able to metabolize glucose.
Okay.
So as estrogen falls, and estrogen also functions as an antioxidant in the brain, so it's protective, but the glucose factor is very, very important, and that's something that I focus on in the book quite a bit, because energy metabolism in your brain is critical. If you're not able to burn energy to keep those cells thriving and working, well, you're going to run into some cognitive problems as you age for sure. And the problem with women is that if they're going into low estrogen, it slowly puts them at risk as they age because they're not able to support energy metabolism. They're no longer able to burn, you know, glucose.
Okay.
So it's very, very important for them to be
okay.
aware of this problem at menopause, if not earlier, because if they don't make a change in their diet and how they approach their diet as far as supplying energy, they have to start thinking about going more into fat metabolism and away from glucose metabolism. And that's an area of diet that's referred to as ketogenesis.
Okay.
And that's a very important part, because in ketogenesis, it also applies to type 2 diabetes. You can reverse type 2 diabetes with a ketogenic approach.
Wait a minute.
With a ketogenic approach.
Are you saying that it can be reversed? Alzheimer's?
Type 2 diabetes can absolutely be reversed with a diet. They've shown that very clearly, and there's many doctors and clinics doing that right now as we speak.
Okay. Type 2 diabetes, yes, I agree with you. But I thought you were talking about Alzheimer's could be reversed through diet, and that was my question.
Well, here's something about Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's has at least a 20 to 30-year window, okay, that it progresses and gets worse as time rolls on. Now, in the very early stages of Alzheimer's, it's called preclinical, there are no signs whatsoever. You don't know that the disease is happening, and your doctor does not either. And in the preclinical stage, that can go on for years and years before it continues into the next stage, which is called mild cognitive impairment. And in mild cognitive impairment is when you start to see problems with memory and executive function that I talked about earlier, thinking, planning, decision making. So all of that starts to happen in mild cognitive impairment. Now, there are some doctors and clinics that are working with patients at mild cognitive impairment before it progresses to a more severe form of Alzheimer's disease. And they're able to stabilize patients. And there is some indications that it can be reversed at that stage.
All right. Now,
so it depends on what stage we're talking about.
Okay.
It's all about early intervention, and that's what I emphasize in the book over and over and over.
Okay.
You can't wait until you have dementia to address this problem. You've got to attack it early in life.
We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back.
The world premiere of the brand new single, I Can Love You Through Anything, by musician, singer, songwriter, and producer, Ken Hardio.
I can love you.
Featuring Charlotte, North Carolina's very own musician, singer, songwriter, music educator, and producer, Quentin Bethay. This song has a message of hope and healing for people of all ages across the globe. Get your copy now. Available on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Google Play.
Thank you for listening to the Faith Connection Show. And here's Dr. Miller with his special guest.
Ralph, the last question that I have for you is, I noticed that in the research, there is very little data on African Americans when it comes to Alzheimer's. Is there a reason for that?
There's absolutely a reason, and it's well described in the literature, again, in the science and the studies. And African Americans and Hispanics have a higher incidence, a higher rate of Alzheimer's risk as they age. And the main reasons are because of diabetes and heart disease. Those two factors alone significantly will raise anybody's risk for Alzheimer's as they age. And again, that's talked about in the book quite a bit. But because African Americans and Hispanics have higher incidences of diabetes and heart disease as they age, they're going to be at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease, late onset Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Now, that's interesting. And certainly, I'm glad to understand why the disparity is there, because I just couldn't figure out exactly why it was. But I have seen that not only in your literature, but also in other literature that I've read about Alzheimer's. Now, let me ask you, is it more people who are more susceptible to having Alzheimer's? Are those the people that where they've had a mom or a dad or someone in the family that suffered from that?
Absolutely. So it's very, very clear that if Alzheimer's or dementia runs in your family, you are definitely at an increased risk. So people, please listen. If something in your background, in terms of your family history, you have to start looking at your risk early in life. because we know, again, that Alzheimer's begins 20 to 30 years, and there's even indications that children start to have problems that increases their risk later in life for Alzheimer's disease, and it relates to obesity and diabetes, heart disease. So you have to start thinking way ahead. If it runs in your family, or if there's a family history of some type, especially on your mother's side, you have to get busy and you have to start working with somebody that understands these problems and these risk factors and can guide you and coach you along what you need to do to protect yourself as you age.
Our time is running out, and I want our listening audience to have an opportunity to hear how to get in contact with you, because I think you consult in this area. And it's important that this side of functional medicine is addressing Alzheimer's, because it is a tough disease. Would you tell our listening audience how to contact you, and certainly how to get your book?
Absolutely. So there are several ways. My main website is thealzheimerssolution.com. And my program, which is titled Brain Defend, is my brain health coaching and consulting program, where I guide people along on how to reduce their risk. And we look very carefully at the risk factors. And that program is called Brain Defend. And they can go to braindefend.com to start looking at that. And they can reach me through either of those .coms, the Alzheimerssolution.com or braindefend.com. And if they want to know more about the book, they can find out more about the book at thediabeticbrain.com.
Okay.
So lots of ways to get in touch with me.
Okay. Well, Ralph, it's been great having you on the show, and we thank you for taking out of your busy schedule time to be with us today. And you have a great rest of your day, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you very much again. It was really a pleasure, and I really appreciate the opportunity, Dr. Miller. You have a wonderful day, too.
Okay, you do the same.
Come on, make a change, say.
Conflict is a very difficult thing to deal with, and we live through conflict every day. But one of the things about conflict that we must realize is that conflict is necessary. It is necessary because conflict is difficult, but it is extremely necessary because it reveals the truth in our lives. Someone out there is going through a great conflict today. You're conflicted about your home, conflicted about your job, and it seems like the conflict you're going through makes your life extremely difficult to deal with. But I want you to know, you must embrace your conflicts, because conflict brings forth personal growth and insight. It helps you to understand who you are and whose you are and how you're able to overcome things. The Bible says that we're more than conquerors because we're able to handle conflict by the grace of God. You know, the greatest conflict in life bring us the greatest tribulations in life. And sometimes those tribulations bring to us a great deliverance. The civil rights movement is a great example of conflict at its best. It was a conflict that brought forth people and pulled people together of all races and colors. It brought people to a sense of understanding and love for one another. Even in your home, you must deal with conflict, because in your home, conflict allows you to understand that it's better to talk to each other than to talk at each other. Your children, your family, everybody has conflict in their lives. So embrace your conflicts. Embrace your conflicts. Because if you're able to embrace your conflicts, you will understand that peace can come out of conflict. Because our great president, Ronald Reagan, once said, "Peace is not absent of conflict. It is the ability to handle conflict by peaceful means." So I admonish you today as we close, understand your conflicts and understand how to handle conflict, because conflict is necessary in order to improve and strengthen your life. Embrace your conflicts.
Thank you for listening to the Faith Connection Show with Dr. David Miller, making a connection for you and equipping people to connect with their purpose. Don't forget to log on to theconnectcenternc.com. That's connectcenternc.com. If you'd like to reach Dr. David Miller, email theconnectcenter3@gmail.com. That's theconnectcenter3@gmail.com. And remember, never lose the connection to your purpose. It's time for the Faith Connection Show with your host, Dr. David Miller, equipping people to connect with their purpose. In the next half hour, you will be inspired with words of encouragement, and you'll be motivated by experts in the respective field who have been where you're trying to go on the Faith Connection Show. But first, here's an inspirational word.
This is Bwana Miller Cannon with your word of the day. Your true passion isn't in your career or the amount of money you make. You must search for the real you, the person buried under other people's perception of you. Are you truly the person they perceive you to be? If not, start living your reality, not your perception. Discover who you are and whose you are, and watch your passion and purpose produce the profession and paycheck you desire. Philippians 4:13 says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me."
Thank you for listening to the Faith Connection Show. And here's Dr. Miller with his special guest.
We have in the studio with us today Rocky Cabagnat, who is an attorney in the city of Charlotte, North Carolina. And Rocky, we're just glad to have you on the show with us today, because we've got some exciting things to talk about with our audience today. And we know you're going to fulfill us with that great connection point today when it comes to law and nonprofit.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Dr. Miller.
Listen, Rocky, tell us just a little bit about yourself, because I want the audience to kind of grasp your history a little bit, and then we'll talk through some other things.
Okay, well, I am a native of Salisbury, North Carolina, and I went to North Carolina for undergrad, so I'm a proud Tar Heel. Mm-hmm. I attended law school down in Gainesville, Florida, so I'm also a part-time Florida Gator as well. I got cut my teeth in practicing law down in Florida, in North Central Florida, as a legal services attorney.
Okay.
And so that's how I kind of got into the game, so to speak, in public interest law. And I spent about 8 years down in Florida, you know, sort of doing work in landlord-tenant, consumer protection. But the biggest area that I did, and this is a segue into nonprofits, was that I started working with community organizations, faith-based organizations focused on affordable housing. And so that was an area of law. They sometimes call it community economic development.
Okay.
And so as a legal services attorney, I provided, you know, legal services to those organizations that were trying to, you know, develop, rehab, build, conserve affordable housing for low income and you know, working class folks. And so my sort of tour of duty, because, you know, when you're doing public interest work, it's a little bit like soldiering, right?
You're right.
Because you're out there, it's thankless, but, you know, at the same time, you feel like you're, you know, I mean, they've always told us at conferences, you're doing God's work, right? You know,
right.
Because if you're serving the poor, and those who can't afford an attorney, you know, there's always that old saying is that what's more infuriating than a poor person is a poor person with an attorney.
Yes. Well, you know, the scriptures are correct about that. It says when you give to the poor, you lend to God, man.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal that. I'm taking that, yeah.
Man. Well, I stole it from the Bible.
Oh, okay.
Let me say it that
all
way.
Right.
Now, you know, Rocket, in North Carolina, and of course, that's the area where you practice law,
mm-hmm.
there are 120,000 nonprofits in North Carolina, and only about 36,000, I think, are tax exempt.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Charlotte area, where you primarily practice, there are about 427 in the Charlotte area.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to have your hands full with having to give instructions to that many nonprofits, because I think your practice that you're doing now lends itself to mm-hmm. Nonprofit law. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
There are nonprofits that are private people that are wanting to do a nonprofit that are listening to us today.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, what is the very first step that someone should take in order to set up a nonprofit?
Okay. This happens quite a lot. And so many nonprofits start with their genesis comes in a very, you know, various means. A lot of times there's a founder, and usually maybe there's one person, and they see in the world around them a social ill,
mm-hmm.
whether it be, you know, diabetes to just homelessness to autism, you name it, the environment, they feel very passionate about this. And so the idea is that, well, I've heard about a nonprofit, I've heard about 501c3, I've heard about tax exempt. And a lot of those terms, some are very separate from a legal aspect, but
well, why don't
mm-hmm.
we stop just a moment
sure.
in the interview, and for the listeners' sake, let's tell the difference between a 501c3 and, you know, standard non.
Okay,
talk to us a little bit about
sure.
that.
Sure. So in North Carolina, there are a number of business entities that you can choose to incorporate. So that's the first step if you're going to. And so there, obviously, you know. There's a limited liability company, a corporation. Well, one of the choices is called not-for-profit corporation, and that's the one that you would want to choose. And so you go to the state, you pay $60, and you file something called Articles of Incorporation, and you fill out the form there and answer certain questions, and voila, you will be given something called a North Carolina not-for-profit corporation. So it's
right.
a business. So
okay.
that's the step. So that what a lot of people get mistaken is that $60 to Raleigh does not get you a 501c3 tax exemption. And so the problem with that is that to get the tax exemption, you have to incorporate, and then you have to apply to the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service.
Rocky, we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to hear from Kalante Gavin. This is No Ordinary Worship. And then we're going to come back and hear some more interesting thoughts about nonprofits.
This ain't no ordinary. Tell a story about a woman with an issue. Had it 12 long years, didn't know what to do. She heard about a man coming through her town. She felt
to her knees and crawled on the ground. Oh, this is what she said, yo. She said, if I could only touch but the gift of his garment, I'ma give it all I have. Lonely. Come on, help me see. Crucified for you and me. This man only wanted to make us free. Oh yes he did.
Oh yes he did.
Listen y'all. But in 3 days he rose with all power.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
3 days he rose with all
power.
Thank you for listening to the Faith Connection Show. And here's Dr. Miller with his special guest.
You hit something there that I wanted to discuss. You said it is a business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people sometimes confuse mm-hmm. because they're thinking, okay, if I'm going to do a business, I'm doing an LLC or yeah. something like that. But when you form a nonprofit, you're actually forming a business.
Absolutely.
But you're actually saying that the business is not for my profit
mm-hmm.
as an LLC would be, but it is for, so, and I'll let you explain that.
Yeah, so really the major difference between, let's say, if you start a corporation, a for-profit corporation, and a nonprofit corporation, is what you do with the profits.
Right.
That's the okay. only real difference. So having a board of directors, following, you know, corporate formalities like having minutes and other things of that nature, all those are the same. Where they deviate, really, in a real essence, is what you can do with the profits. If you have a for-profit, you can declare a dividend. I helped found this company, if we had a good year, you can give me some of the money, right?
Okay.
I can get a bonus or something like that. With a nonprofit, say for instance, we got our overhead was $50,000. We got $100,000 in grants and donations. I can't just, you know, oh, well, I did a really good job. I'm the founder of the nonprofit and I can take, you know, $25,000 out of that. No, you have to reinvest any profits into the mission.
Okay.
And so for-profit organizations are more or less profit-driven, and nonprofits are mission-driven.
Right.
And so those are kind of the differences, but how they operate, from having to follow most of the, you know, like requirements of paying unemployment taxes, workers' compensation, you know, all those sort of things, they all apply to nonprofits. And, you know, I think that that's, you know, when you have a big heart and you feel the spirit and you're very, you know, interested in doing, you know, changing the world, a lot of times the idea of half owning a business and running a business as a nonprofit trips people up.
Right. Now, you know, a person with real passion generally wants to commit themselves to full time, this kind of thing. Can they take a salary from a nonprofit?
Well, yes, yes, absolutely. In fact, this is my last week of being executive director at a nonprofit in Salisbury.
Right.
And I have a salary.
Okay.
You know, there's, I think that one of the, if there's one thing that people can take away is that you don't have to take a vow of poverty to be in a nonprofit, okay?
That's
true. You can't necessarily enrich yourself, you know, with profits.
Mm-hmm.
That's on one end. But on the other end, you know, no, it's not all, you don't all have to be volunteer. It's not Mother Teresa in Calcutta
right.
every day, you know, with a nonprofit. It, you know, nonprofits have to hire people. They have to, you know, they have to be able to recruit the right people, because if you have a strong mission, you've got to have the right staff and the right leadership and management to get it done. And so people aren't going to work for free. And
right.
so you've got to raise the money and you got to pay the money out in salaries and out in overhead and operations.
So really the only difference is that you may not be selling or producing a certain commodity or whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. but the people who are generous enough to give to the nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
they're giving to it to promote the work of that nonprofit, which you have to hire professionals and people who can make that happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So many founders, you know, eventually, now, one thing that is one idea and a tip that I would give to your listeners is once the founder gets to a point where you can start taking a salary, you know, because of the conflict of interest, you should step off the board of directors that you most likely are chairing, most likely, and become the CEO and subject to the board of directors.
Right.
And because, you know, there is an inherent conflict of interest from a nonprofit perspective if, you know, I'm deciding the pay for myself. You can kind of see where maybe in a for-profit area, you know, like Jeff Bezos and I have Amazon, I can, you know, determine my pay. But
right.
nonprofits, there's a lot, there is a little bit more focus on good governance and corporate formalities. What I'm trying to say is I'm not discouraging anyone who has a passion, has a vision, wants to be a founder, and then eventually wants to sort of, you quote unquote, do well by doing good. Is that there is a, you know, there is a right way to make that transition from founding a nonprofit and then taking a salary from it. And mm-hmm. as a plug, those are the sort of things where if you want to, you know, that I can help you with.
Now, if you are setting up a nonprofit and that you come to that point, how selecting the board of directors
mm-hmm.
is extremely important. And
Absolutely.
Most founders of nonprofits really do a poor job in selecting a board of directors. Can you tell us just a little bit about that? I know our time is winding up, but if you could tell us a little bit about that, I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, you know, there's many ways of starting a board of directors. You know, number one is getting your head around the idea that you have to have a board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
Because many founders, you know, a lot of them think they're sole proprietors. Many of them
right.
think that this is my business, this is my baby, I started this. It's, you know, I'm the one who put the money in. I'm the one who hired that attorney to, like, you know, start this nonprofit,
right.
you
right.
know. And so, number one, I think, is just getting the idea that you have to share power.
Okay.
Now,
sharing power is not easy.
It's not. It's
okay.
not, particularly if it's your vision, right?
That's
and then you've
true.
Got, it's like
That's true.
Starting a band, right? If
right.
If my vision, these are my songs, and then somebody wants to, you know, start playing something in a different key, I'm like, no. This is my vision. This is, and so... So number one, prepare to the notion of sharing power. If you're not interested in sharing power but doing good, and this may be a topic of another discussion, there's a whole area called social entrepreneurship where many people, Ben and Jerry's and other, you know, even the King's Kitchen downtown, are utilizing for-profit entities but doing social good.
Right,
and so
right,
if
right.
you really are just against the idea of sharing power, there are other means to do that, but if you're going to do the nonprofit route, nonprofit corporation route, you got to learn to share power.
Okay, but there are a lot of nonprofit corporations, mm-hmm. I mean, we're for-profit corporations
mm-hmm.
that have nonprofit corporations. And in those cases, sometimes they're using their own earnings to promote the good that they want to do in the community. Can a for-profit own a nonprofit?
Well, nobody really owns a nonprofit.
Okay, and I'm so, sorry about
so
that.
So you can now, oh, now there, so with a nonprofit, the difference between another difference between that and a for-profit, when we talk about power, it really comes down to voting.
Mm-hmm.
So you can structure your bylaws in the sense that the founder, the incorporator, maybe it's the corporation or their representative, has more voting power. You know, so. And a lot of times in a for-profit, you have more voting power. It means that's more ability to get more money out of the venture. But with a nonprofit, it a lot of times it just comes down to, can I choose who's on your board of directors?
Yes.
Can I choose the direction of where
Correct.
You're going?
Yeah.
And so the board of directors is the place where those heavy decisions are made. But then who's on your board of directors? And so a lot of the devil's in the details is where lawyers come in. Is number one, you have to check your articles of incorporation. If there's any language in there, that's going to trump everything. Or in your corporate bylaws.
Mm-hmm.
And if the bylaws say something, you know, that these certain members have, or these certain, directors, or how you classify them, have more voting power than another type of director, that's how founders can, you know, sort of ensure that their vision is involved. And that's the kind of thing I do. Is that particularly if I'm working with a founder, you know, I try to work with them to draft bylaws in a way that ensures that they can't be kicked out. You know, like Ben and Jerry's, you know, they got real excited about doing social good and they went public, and then all the shareholders are like, we're not really interested in that. And so they got kicked out of their own company, you know. And so another thing is, the best time to kind of make these decisions is at the front end when everybody's happy. That goes for both for-profits and non-profits. Is when everyone's at the front end, people are more amenable to changes and thinking and being more collaborative. And that's the time where the documents that you produce, the governance documents you produce, they should be done at that time. Because when people are ticked off at each other and they're lawyering up, and you didn't have the right documents in the first place.
We're going to take a quick break here. We'll be right back.
The world premiere of the brand new single, I Can Love You Through Anything, by musician, singer, songwriter, and producer, Ken Hardio.
I can love you through anything.
Featuring Charlotte, North Carolina's very own musician, singer, songwriter, music educator, and producer, Quentin Bethay. This song has a message of hope and healing for people of all ages across the globe. Get your copy now. Available on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Google Play.
So really, a lot of it has to do with where you start this.
Yes.
Yeah, and of course, that's what you do is, as an attorney, this is your primary area of interest, and you can help people get off to the right start.
If they, you know, helping them get started on the right track. But, you know, if you're, you know, midstream, you know, and you're already there, I mean, there's a good chance for you to have an attorney there to kind of, you know, revise your bylaws and you know, also the dynamic. If you've got a board of directors and you've got an executive director and a staff, and there's inherent, and trust me, I've been through this, there's inherent issues between sharing power, between what's the difference between governance and management. One thing that an attorney can do is to sort of help both in writing and also just through mediating, is just figure, you know, helping that group figure out what the happy mean is.
Well, you know, and that does become a problem, because even with a nonprofit or for-profit, when it gets big enough and the numbers are huge,
mm-hmm.
It becomes a problem with power, because
we're humans.
Yeah, we're humans. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the real issue is. You know, Rocky, I think what we really need to do is make this a two-part show.
I'm
because
down with that.
This is just really interesting, because there are a lot of people out there that really have some great ideas
mm-hmm.
about doing good in the community. And, hey, it looks like that what we're doing is great, but all of a sudden what started out to be good
mm-hmm.
ends up in a bad way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what I'd like to do is maybe make this a sort of a two-part interview, because I've got some people that are starting up nonprofits, and
mm-hmm.
it would be great to have a conversation
sure.
with both sides on the show. So we're going to bring you back on the show,
Absolutely.
Rocky, and we're going to sit down and talk about this, because your practice is in Charlotte, North Carolina, even though
mm-hmm.
our show is syndicated, and we're all over the U.S. as well as foreign countries, but I think we should have this conversation, because I think there are people all over the U.S. starting up nonprofits,
yes.
and
yes.
even some nonprofits that are servicing overseas areas.
Yes.
So that will be great for us. Now, just before we close, Rocky, I want you to tell a listening audience mm-hmm. how to make contact with you, because they may need your services. And then we're going to come back in part two.
Okay.
And we're going to bring some nonprofit entrepreneurs on board with us.
Okay. Well, I am actually, as of October 1st, joining the law firm of Hull and Chandler in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I can be reached at 704-375-8488. That'll be starting October 1st.
Okay.
Again, that's 704-375-8488. And I'm just ask for Rocky.
Okay. That sounds great. All right. It's been great having you on the show, and we look forward to having you back on part two.
I'm excited. Thank you so much, Dr. Miller.
All right.
Never would have made it. Never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. But now I see how you were there for me, and I can say, never would have made it. Never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. But now I see how you were there for me, and I can say, I'm stronger, I'm wiser, I'm better, much better. When I look back over all you brought me through, I can see that you are the one I held on to, and I never, never would have made it. Oh, I never could have made it.
In an angry world, a world that is so angry until it seems like that we're doing evil to one another. But we must remember that whenever we're living in an angry world, we have to deal with angry people. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the hearts of every human being. So it's not just one person, it's every person. If you're out there today and you're struggling because it seems like evil has been done to you, and people seem to be angry with you about something of the past or something that has just recently happened, Don't let that kind of anger force you to do things that you know is not the right thing to do. Because anger is never without reason, but seldom is the reason a good one. So that means that you have to remember that whatever people do, whatever a man sows, he must also reap. So reaping time will soon come. But also remember that Joseph was the prime example of when evil is done to you, the approach that you must take. You remember when Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery, but after they sold him into slavery, Joseph prospered in the midst of that. So what does that mean? What they meant for evil, God meant for good. So just remember that when evil is done to you, remember the story of Joseph. What they meant for evil, God means for good.
Thank you for listening to the Faith Connection Show with Dr. David Miller, making a connection for you and equipping people to connect with their purpose. Don't forget to log on to the ConnectCenterNC.com. That's ConnectCenterNC.com. If you'd like to reach Dr. David Miller, email theconnectcenter3@gmail.com. That's theconnectcenter3@gmail.com. And remember, never lose the connection to your purpose.